The final argument for oral argument this morning is FMB Bank Shares, Inc. versus Douglas Hayek. For the appellant, Hayek is Stephen Sanford, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellee, FMB Bank Shares, is John Thieler, an attorney from Mitchell. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself from this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Rodney Steele, presiding judge of the Third Circuit, to sit in his place. Mr. Sanford, you may proceed, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please, the court, counsel,
I'm Stephen Sanford from Sioux Falls. I'm here representing Doug Hayek, the appellant in this case. This matter presents to the court an issue of contract interpretation, what two contracts governing the same subject mean. The overall question, while it's broken down into several issues, the overall broad question is whether Doug Hayek can be compelled legally to submit for redemption at a bargain basement price stock he was issued in the plaintiff, FMB Bank Shares. The intent of the parties on that question is clearly and expressly stated in the contract. The trial court, and this is why we're here, refused to honor the stated intent of the parties and instead speculated beyond the contract about what the parties must have intended instead of what they said they intended in the contract. Just as a brief bit of background to give context to the argument this morning, Doug Hayek was in 1997 a practicing lawyer with a thriving law practice in Sioux Falls. He had prior experience in banking before he went to law school. In furtherance of that, he formed a company and obtained the right to buy First American Bank in Canton, South Dakota. The plaintiff was then a client of his firm, so he mentioned this right to Dan Cooley, who was the chairman of FMB Bank Shares. As a result of that discussion over a long period of negotiations, the parties agreed that Doug's company, that had the right to buy the Canton Bank, and the plaintiff, the holding company for Cooley's bank, would merge. And out of that agreement, Doug was going to then go to work for the bank and abandon his law practice. In exchange for giving up his law practice, Doug received in broad strokes three things. Was promised three things, anyway. First of all, a cash payment to equalize the lower salary he was going to take as a bank employee versus what he was earning as a lawyer. Two, he was going to have an employment contract that would allow him to leave the employ of the bank whenever he felt like it for any reason. And third, that he would, in exchange for his ownership of this company that had the right to buy the Canton Bank, he would receive shares of FMB that he had the option to either keep as long as he wanted, or when he left his employment, to compel FMB to redeem those shares at a favorable price formula that's stated in the contract. This third benefit is what is at issue in this case, because Hayek, Doug resigned eventually from his employment and went back to practicing law. The issue is governed by two agreements.
Is the reason for the resignation material to this case at all?
It was a trial, but it's not an issue on appeal.
All right.
We could go into that at length, but it doesn't have.
The briefs didn't seem to dwell on it, and I just wondered if it was. And you say it's not, that's fine.
It's not material.
Okay.
Because it's not being appealed. The two agreements are both dated December 23, 1997. The first agreement sets forth the overall plan of the merger of the employment terms, and how all that is going to be handled. Paragraph 4 of the original agreement, in very plain terms that nobody is arguing about, either at the trial level or here, states that if Doug's employment with the bank ends for any reason whatsoever, voluntarily or involuntarily, he has a 90-day window which to make the bank buy the shares from him at a favorable price formula. But it's his option only. FMB is not contending that one agreement gave the bank the right to purchase them if Doug didn't want to sell them. The effect of the second agreement, which came after, although it's dated the same day, is what brings all of us here. The second agreement has a different price structure to the redemption under certain circumstances if he voluntarily leaves the bank, voluntarily resigns, or is terminated for cause. So the principal issue with the two contracts is, does that second contract merely change the price under certain circumstances under which the bank would pay Hayek for his shares if Hayek elected his option? Or the competing interpretation is, does it grant to the bank or the holding company, FMB, what it didn't have under the first purchase agreement? And that is the right or option itself to compel redemption even if Hayek did not exercise his option when he resigned. Okay, those are the two competing interpretations. The odds of my ever being a judge are pretty low, but I would think, thinking as a lawyer, what a judge would think when faced with a contract about which competing interpretations are argued, one might say, gee whiz, why didn't the parties just say what they intended, that my job would be so much easier? Well, here we have a very unique situation in which the parties expressly stated what the purpose of the second agreement was in relation to those two competing interpretations I just said. And in fact, in the preamble, the second agreement with the different pricing structure says, and if I may quote, the parties hereto wish to clarify the price at which Hayek shares of FMB Bank stock are to be redeemed by FMB pursuant to paragraph 4 of the memorandum and agreement under certain circumstances. Paragraph 4 is the paragraph of the original agreement that gives Doug an option, not FMB an option to purchase Doug's shares. So the parties expressly stated, as between those two competing interpretations, that all they're doing is intending to clarify the price at which the shares would be purchased under paragraph 4, which was Doug's option. So nowhere in any of the agreements does it say that FMB is granted an option to purchase Doug's shares at any time. And of course, this is very important to the parties because the pricing formula in the second agreement is at a bargain basement price substantially less than fair market value. So FMB wants to try to compel redemption because they get it at a low price. Doug wants to hang on to the shares because they're worth far more than that. So that's the issue. The court rejected the express statement of the parties as to their intent and instead tried to speculate about, if he left voluntarily, they'd want to buy his stock. This must be an option instead of reading the contract and observing what the parties expressly stated was the intent. This extra contract speculation by the trial court violates this court's holdings over and over again. Read the contract, and if the intent is discernible from the contract, apply it. That's the end. And that should have been the end here. In particular, some time ago, this court said Quick v. Bakke, that courts should not engage in speculation about the intent, where the intent is stated in the contract. And we respectfully suggest that the trial court erred in that respect by engaging in its own speculation as to what must have been meant instead of reading the contract and accepting what the party said the contract meant and what the second contract's purpose was.
Did the trial court cite any particular provision in either one of these agreements on which it based its interpretation?
No. The court's ruling was oral at a hearing on competing motions for judgment on the pleadings. The transcript of the hearing is part of the record. He has about a page or so of explanation, but did not cite any specific provision to support his interpretation.
Is it your client's position then today that there's no question of fact that you're entitled to win as a matter of law?
Yes, that's very correct. Obviously, construction of an unambiguous contract by a trial court is a question of law, as this court has held. Determining whether a contract is ambiguous or not ambiguous is also a question of law. And in this case, the court said it's unambiguous and it means this. Under those parameters, it is a question of law for this court. There is another very fundamental reason why FMB should not be able to compel Hayek to surrender his shares at a bargain basement price. That second reason is even if the trial court were correct that despite what the party said the intent was, the contract does grant a right or option to FMB to require Doug to sell his shares at a low price, that right still has to be exercised. And because the party didn't contemplate that FMB would have this right, no time was specified. In other words, FMB, for instance, couldn't wait 10 years and say, oh, by the way, we want to now buy your shares for this bargain basement price. But no time, unlike Hayek's option, which he had to exercise in 90 days, no time is set for the supposed exercise of the supposed right or option. So under case law and statute, a reasonable time is implied. Mr. Pewley, on behalf of FMB, admitted at trial at pages 234 and 35 that that reasonable time was a 90-day window after Hayek left his employ, the employ of the holding company and the bank. That date, that is, the date he left, was January 31, 2000. All right, so under Mr. Hewley's interpretation, by which FMB is bound, bank then had 90 days from January 31 to exercise its supposed right. That would put it at the end of April of 2000. The only statement or exercise attempt during that window of time was a letter from Mr. Hewley accusing Mr. Hayek of contractual wrongdoing and said, okay, we get your shares for $100. And if you don't take it, we're gonna sue you. The parties agree the price under the formula, if there were such a right, is about $268,000. So the question, which I think answers itself, is a demand that a person surrender a $268,000 right for $100, is that a proper exercise? Well, no, it's not. We've cited cases in our brief which clearly hold that you can't exercise a right of sell-off as an exercise of an option. And by the way, the contractual breach accusations made by Mr. Hewley were never attempted to be proved at trial. They abandoned that idea long before trial. So the question is the demand to pay only $100 for a $268,000 right, is that a valid exercise or not? And that's very important because this court has held that if an option is not timely exercised, it's over.
Did the court say that the shares were redeemable for $100?
No. The court held it was the $268,000 fee.
Right.
And the court held that this $100 offer was a valid exercise without giving any particular reason for it. In fact, the first time that FMB said anything about paying anything other than $100 was months after. Right? It was not until September. Even that September of 2000, even that price was not the contract price. Really, the first time that any offer was made to purchase stock at the contract price, this $268,000, was more than a year after Hayek's employment ended. Mr. Hewley admitted to trial. It's an undisputed fact, fully reliable or to be relied on by this court, that it was a 90-day window in which to accomplish the redemption. As a matter of undisputed fact, because $100 was the only thing used, but within that 90-day window, there wasn't a valid exercise. So they have no right. Doug was prejudiced by the delay, as is not being disputed by FMB, because when he left the bank, he had three children in college. He took a lower-paying job, and because of the delay, he had to withdraw money from his retirement plan, pay the penalty and the tax on it, because FMB was saying, sorry, we get your stock for $100 and not the $268,000. So
that's just a choice, though. He could have borrowed the money at the bank. He could have hit up a relative, maybe borrowed it from the law firm or the law firm he's going to. I mean, that's the fact that he elected to take his retirement and then pay the penalty. I mean, that's really neither here nor there, is it?
Well, I mean, under any of the alternatives, and I appreciate the court's point, but that wasn't the evidence at trial. But under any of the suggestions Justice Sabers just made, there would be an expense incurred, interest, that kind of thing, and so he would have been financially harmed. There's no evidence that he could have borrowed from Davenport Evans, or they would have lent him money, or anything like that. So all the record shows is that he did incur this penalty. Under the Europe's alternatives, he would incur expense as well. I agree with you. That's the choice he made.
Anything in the record about the marketability of these shares? Hayek kept these shares. He eventually sold them. Could he sell them to anybody? Is there anything in the record of that, or whether these wills are divisible by will or whatever?
There is a shareholders agreement that was not put into evidence. Mr. Hayek testified that in his opinion, the shares were worth probably three times that much. I don't know if three times was used, but it was that equivalent.
Buy-sell agreement in the shareholders agreement?
The shareholders agreement is not evidence, but I'll tell you that it's a typical deal where if he wants to sell to an outside shareholder or somebody who's not already a shareholder, FMB or the existing shareholders have an option to meet the price. So, but we're kind of off the record, and I wouldn't ask the court to rely on that because it's not on the record.
So what we are talking about, though, that is in the record is the difference. The shares are going to go from Mr. Hayek back to the corporation. but either for a quarter of a million or three quarters of a million. Is that what it boils down to?
No, it doesn't boil down to that. Doug wants to keep his shares.
Oh, okay.
We're not, he had a 90-day window to force the exercise, in other words, to force FMB to redeem his shares. He let that pass. Did not exercise that right because he simply wants to keep the shares. So he's not trying to force FMB to do anything. And if this court ruled in favor of Hayek, that's the way it would end. I mean, FMB would have no obligation to purchase his shares at any price. Doug will simply ride out the fortunes of the bank.
Well, if he wants to keep his shares, your comments with Justice Sabres about these damages he supposedly sustained are really kind of not off the mark, aren't they? If he's going to keep the shares, he can't do both, cash them in and keep them.
And perhaps I've unintentionally misled the court. At the time, he was open to selling his shares. There are at least two pieces of correspondence from him that he would be open to either keeping his shares or getting paid the market, or getting paid the contract price for it. He needed the money. But now that he's spent the retirement, you know, made the withdrawal from his retirement plan, he testified, I'd just soon keep him. That's the issue.
Okay.
My time's up. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. We'll be back for 10 minutes. Mr. Thieler, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Okay, please report. Jack Thieler on behalf of the Bank Shares Corporation. Mr. Sanford, counsel at clerk's table. Just want to get right to a couple of issues, and this matter has been through pleadings and briefing to the court on cross motions, judgment on the pleadings. We've heard exactly what the defense was saying in those motions. The motion was granted, and the plaintiff had a judgment on the pleadings. The court then opened it up. We retried all the factual issues. We got a directed verdict on the same. So going to Justice Meyer Henry's question, which contract provision over in agreement number 2 did the court rely on? And what happened through the motions, through the trial, and now through the appellate process is Mr. Hayek's counsel, and Mr. Hayek wants us to throw out a contract provision. It states, and with the excuse of the court here, notwithstanding, this is paragraph 1 of the second agreement, notwithstanding the provisions of paragraph 4. In other words, paragraph 4 in the memorandum is negotiated, and that was going to be a buyout, voluntary, involuntary, with cause, without cause. And they came back and negotiated, well, wait a minute, we give you the shares coming in, and so we're going to, this bargain basement, there's no evidence of bargain basement in the Justice Hill. $3.99 was the ESOP price at the end of the year. That's twice the transactions took place within the ESOP. But the second agreement negotiated to take this installment through a tier of 5 years. If you leave or you're fired for cause in 5 years, we do the following. And we clarified the price and the preamble. They want you to take the preamble of that agreement and throw out the following. Quote, notwithstanding the provisions of paragraph 4 of the memorandum agreement, in the event Hayek voluntarily resigns, which he did, as was agreed to by counsel, or if his employment described in the memorandum is terminated for cause, which is an issue, FMB shall redeem all of Hayek's shares. And the court found, and there are 14 findings of fact, that there would have to be...
To that?
Pardon?
Isn't there another phrase to that last sentence you just quoted?
Is there another phrase to it in the agreement?
Well, I know there is. It says, pursuant to paragraph 4BI at the following redemption price.
Yeah, pursuant, and that's where you go in and come up with the calculation as to the what they refer to as bargain price, and minority shares sell at discount. They aren't marketable. Who buys subchapter S stock? Small minority shares.
Talking about whether FMB shall redeem his stock or whether they shall redeem the stock at the prices listed in there.
Right. Now, I agree totally, and the court found exactly that provision, and we've cited repeatedly through this three-stage process, the Kimball Investment Land, and our court has said repeatedly that we take, and there's two agreements, but let's call it one. Everybody, both sides agree two are one. You take all four corners, and is there an interpretation that makes all the language, the first paragraph four, the second article one, and all of the subparts, which are the mathematical pricing, and give them sense? And if not, under the defense's interpretation, the phrase that I just read you, the whole paragraph one of that agreement, you have to throw it out.
One other question, I'll leave you alone.
Okay. I'm here to be bothered.
4BI, it says in there. Is that a, that's a typo, isn't it?
It is. Everybody agreed that was a typo.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep, that's on the record. So the Kimball case, the Kimball Land Investment case, 2000, this court said we have to, if you can rationally, logically interpret everything within the agreement, it's still not ambiguous, and the court found, as a matter of fact, and as a matter of law, it's not ambiguous. If it was, Mr. Hyatt drafted it, as counsel said, in the perfect world, lawyers never make mistakes, but it would be his counsel, his client, who was counsel for himself, over there at Boyce Murphy, counsel for the bank, that drafted all the agreements. But very clearly, we have to throw out that. We have to throw out Article 1 of the second agreement. And shall has no wiggle room. Redemption is not an option. We keep hearing they didn't exercise their option. They didn't exercise their option. It's a mandatory redemption. They, even in their brief, and it wasn't just argued, but said you can't enforce your own obligation. Well, if under the first agreement, had he been terminated without cause, yes, we don't want you anymore, Mr. Hayek. Mr. Hayek then would have a 90-day option that he could exercise. If not, he stays as a shareholder, and he doesn't have the pricing mechanism. But if he's terminated for cause, or if he voluntarily leaves, in a five-year period for his stock that he got free, but that is mandatory redemption. There isn't an exercise. Mandatory redemption on both sides. So had he exercised because he was terminated without cause, their argument would be, well, you can't enforce your own obligation. Well, in purchase agreements to sell a house, one guy sells, one guy buys. One party sells, one party buys, and you can enforce that. So, poor me, I know we kind of sometimes get in front of the court and listen to the jury arguments we heard down there below, and there wasn't a jury there. Poor me, he was paid $499,000, right at $500,000 for 22 months to work for the bank. And it is in the record what he was making at Boyce and what he's making the first year at, as a partner at Evan Bardemis. He came in at about a $220,000, $240,000 a year lawyer. He was quickly replaced when he voluntarily resigned. We only got $155,000 first year partner's salary over there at Davenport Evans. So that factual thing of, and I agree totally, is that circular argument of wasn't going to sell my shares. Well, if he wasn't going to sell the shares, why during these 4 years of only making $500,000? Would he be forced to sell those IRAs?
On this February 18th, 2000 letter, what was the, what do you read this letter that FMB Bank Shares actually offered to pay him? And was it according to this provision that you're saying gives the bank the option, or the mandatory, not an option, the mandatory requirement?
Yes, I agree totally, and that we've appended to our brief 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Nine letters, February 18th, 2000. Mr. Cooley said, we shall redeem, per the contract.
But at what price?
Well, they're going to redeem at the contract price, but they have an offset plan that wasn't abandoned at trial. It was never sued. So if you follow our, and we've made them very simple for the court, exhibits 3 through 9, February 18th, February 21st, Doug responds. March 10th, Dan responds, and again says we'll be redeeming. March 24th, Doug responds. September 29th, Dan will respond. And a party of FMB should not be penalized for not pursuing an offset contractual claim. Mr. Hayek was asked, and he was asked if he ever showed up, and it was on page 121 of the transcript, and asked for his 60% price. And he said no. He could have come in at any time. And if you follow through with the letters, to include the last letter, February 7, 2001, he always said, "I didn't voluntarily resign," all the way through the trial court. When we got done and had the second ruling against him, he was still kicking and screaming that he didn't voluntarily resign. The court made a finding of that and kind of took the same simple language as it did in its interpretation agreements. "I'm notifying you that I intend to resign all my positions." Defendant Exhibit 1. So there was, Justice Meyer Henry, a total exercise, and it's not an exercise, it's notification of complying with the obligation.
And that was within the 90-day period?
Within the 90 days. He actually sent that first letter, hand-delivered, January 8th, and the only thing left was the payment. He then picked January 31st. So he walked out of the bank on January 31st and February 18th, and the court made a finding. And as we cited in the Kokish Running, again, I think it's a 2000 or 2001 case from this court, findings have to be erroneous. And the court made 14 findings, all supported, that it was timely exercised, that it was unambiguous, that it was a mandatory redemption, that they agreed, were ready, willing, and able. We haven't gotten an argument, but Mr. Gilley said, "At any time, we'll call the Fed and get the permission, show up for the check." So we full circle back to all the issues. None of them are issues when you go back to Article 1 of the Second Agreement. Where would we put, notwithstanding, all of Article 4 over here? Notwithstanding, no matter what Article 4 says, in plain English, as Mr. Sanford wants us to believe and follow, and the court did follow plain English, notwithstanding, throw that aside, in two circumstances, voluntary resignation and in a firing for cause, we shall pay you back. And of course, if you don't leave within the first 5 years, then you're going to be hanging right in there, and there is nothing in the record about the agreements that would apply going forward. There was some discussion about unsigned agreements and so on, so it certainly is not before the court as to what
doesn't your interpretation though nullify then completely in the first agreement 4A and specifically Hayek's option? Because if we interpret the two together as you're saying, F and B shall redeem him if he voluntarily or involuntarily terminates his employment, yet 4A gives him the option of redeeming him. So the way your interpretation, 4A would never have an effect and he would never have an option.
We set it out in our brief in complete detail, is you can be terminated involuntarily for a lot of reasons that aren't cause. Cause is very narrowly defined.
Okay.
So if he's involuntary, so that is within the Kimball case. That's why we stand on every word in the agreement. We stand on every finding of fact of Judge Anderson. We don't disagree with one conclusion of law. We don't disagree with any of the premises of law that are quoted. We just don't have any application to the facts and the law. The trial court found these things twice. And so
the second agreement, though, would nullify the option that he had in paragraph 1 of the other agreement if he quit voluntarily.
If he quit voluntarily. That's why it said notwithstanding. And if you leave my employee in the first couple of years, the first year, the second year, the third year, 40%, 60%, 80%, you decide not to work for us, those shares we gave you, we don't want to pay full price for. You know, those of us who practice law in the business world, is, and that probably includes all five of the sitting justices here, is that's what continuity agreements are. Subchapter S corporations owned by a few people, when you leave, we throw you out for cause, which isn't an issue here, or you leave because you're mad at us. We don't want you in the shareholders' room. So we have an agreement. the son that leaves the farm. Farm Corporation, what does he have to do? Sell the shares back, tender them back. Someone dies, someone's disabled, they need the employee. That's what these agreements do. Notwithstanding, so I'll take all the language of those two agreements. I do in my brief moments left, because I don't know if it's going to come down to the other issue of interest. But it may be, you know, get up here and rebuttal, is we've set it out in our brief, is that the court has found that since he was a shareholder and received all his benefits, including distributions as a subchapter S shareholder, and he never showed up with his own conduct, that he's not entitled to interest. Arguably, if there was an interest issue on February 7th of 2001, it couldn't be plainer in our Appendix 8 is the final letter that says, here's your argument. We'll drop our offset. And then lastly is the statute 21.113.1 says that there's a contract rate, you don't default to Category F, which is 15%. So, but the trial court, again, made a finding, and it's not clearly erroneous. In fact, it's supported by the record. He was a shareholder, he received all the benefits. He kept saying, I involuntarily left, therefore I don't have to do anything. But the court found otherwise, and counsel has agreed that it is voluntary. So the interest issue, the ready, willing, and able, Mr. Cooley testified that, yes, we could then, we can now perform. We go get the federal approval. And Mr. Hayek knew that, or he would have done the following. Go ahead and redeem. And I won't go through this whole exercise, because I know when the feds say no, I'm still a shareholder. So Mr. Hayek is on the board of bank shares, on the board of bank, president of the bank, and a material operating officer. So that's a smokescreen, ready, willing, and able. Because the bank wouldn't have spent the time and the money in court and wrote all these letters, exhibits, appendix 3 through 8. Or Mr. Cooley would have been wasting his time and his money, and Mr. Hayek certainly didn't need counsel either. He could just let it happen. And he was still contending at trial court, in his opinion, he had been in the bank for a couple of years. They still couldn't do it. Well, if the feds say no, it isn't going to happen. So that's pretty simple, and that issue is a spike in the coffin. Not an option. Mandatory redemption. Two-sided. They've got a couple cases in there that have to do, and they cited in their reply brief that we didn't address them. They got a couple cases for mandamus and prohibition in a criminal case defining dead in Black's Law Dictionary, saying you can't enforce an obligation. And we've already touched on that. And so that's all our responses. I've got 3 minutes left to, so Judge, you can hit me again. You said you were going to be polite and let me speak my piece. I'm over. You know you got a good case when you waste the last 4 minutes.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sanford, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you. Addressing one point that was said kind of toward the end, this is not an option. This is a mandatory redemption. Well, that might have been Mr. Thieler's view, but it wasn't his client's view. Okay, because on September 29, 2000, about 8 months after Doug left, Mr. Cooley writes Doug, and this is item 7 on their appendix. He says, you are hereby advised that FNB Bank Shares does intend to exercise its option to purchase the 1,122.5 shares of FNB stock loan. So, FNB characterizes an option. They claim an option. They have to satisfy the requirements of an option. Now, going back to this contract interpretation issue and counsel's statement that you got to ignore paragraph 1, all right? You can take paragraph 1, white out everything else, okay? Focus only on paragraph 1. And you'd ask yourself the question, Well, does that change only Hayek's option price if he exercised, or is this a new grant? Is this a new grant of an option, a right that did not exist before? And focusing only on paragraph one, the court would ask itself the question. Okay, so which interpretation is right? Well, you can't focus on just one thing. Obviously, the court has said you got to look at all of the entirety of the agreement, and when there are two, you got to read them together. So if you look at the statement of intent in the preliminary statement, the parties hereto wish to clarify the price at which Hayek shares are to be redeemed pursuant to paragraph four of the previous agreement. That states precisely what they intended. Paragraph 4 of the previous agreement is the paragraph that grants only Hayek the option. Okay. So let's think or say, well, what if FMB did intend to get an option they didn't have before? Can we figure out how they would have said it? If Sanford's right, how would they have said it? And you don't need to go beyond these two agreements to know that. If you look at paragraph one of the original agreement, which is appendix one to FMB's brief, at page three at the top, it says, if First Madison Banks, that's FMB's subsidiary, application for permission to establish a branch in Sioux Falls has not been approved by the South Dakota Banking Commission by August 1, 1998. Here's the key language. FMB shall be entitled to redeem all Hayek shares in FMB and revoke the FMB options, all for the payment of $100 to Hayek. Okay, so the bank knows how to take an option if they think they want one. By the way, the application for a Sioux Falls branch was approved, so this option didn't come into play. But the point is that where the contract grants an option to FMB, it says so explicitly. There is nothing in the second agreement that grants an option. All it does is to state an obligation that you place in the context of paragraph four. And when you do that, as the preamble tells you to do, then it is quite obvious, very clear, that the purpose is merely to change the price paid to Hayek if Hayek elects the option for paragraph four. Regarding the amount that has been paid to Doug on other things, we don't come here asking for sympathy. We don't want any more money from FMB bank shares. The money was paid to him under a contractual agreement that the bank entered into freely and voluntarily with the advice of counsel. And I don't think it has any bearing on this, how much he was paid and some of the deal that where they did perform their obligation. The offset issue. If I agree to buy counsel's house for $268,000 and showed up at closing and said, here's a $100 bill, you owe me the rest. Am I going to get a deed? Of course not. And a year later, if I say, oh, okay, never mind, I'll pay the $268,000, can I compel counsel to sell me his house? No, I can't do that. And so this $100 thing is not an exercise. It's just simply a strong arm that the court, the bank never sought to pursue. And they never offered to pay him the $268,000 until a year later, far beyond what Mr. Cooley admitted was the reasonable time, that is 90 days, for doing that. So Mr. Cooley says it's an option. He agrees they didn't agree to pay $268 until over a year after, well beyond his 90 days. This court has held, you got to exercise an option timely or you lose it. They lost it. Regarding the comment about findings, this court has repeatedly held that where a finding is based on a written document or an undisputed fact, that kind of thing is fully reviewable as a matter of law without any deference to the trial court or without showing the finding is clearly erroneous. The trial court made a finding that this February 18 letter offering $100 constitutes an exercise of the option. This court is just as capable of reading the letter for itself, and I suggest should not equate $100 with $268,000. Finally, this issue of Federal Reserve regulatory approval that Mr. Thieler brought up is also part of our appeal. Because of credit card losses in an area supervised by Mr. Pewley, the bank incurred financial problems. The Federal Reserve came in and said and made the bank and all its directors sign an agreement. And the agreement, one piece of it, said that you can't even admit you have an obligation for redemption without asking us first. Okay? And so the fact that the bank, that FMB never, ever asked Federal Reserve approval to admit they had this so-called obligation has great significance, because in Western Petroleum, the court held that where a national bank is prohibited by law from doing something, that if they do it, it's unenforceable. And so the bank had the obligation to prove, it had the burden of proving, that it was ready, able, and willing to accomplish this redemption within the 90-day window. They were prohibited by an agreement that had the force of law to even mentioning they had a redemption obligation without first asking the Federal Reserve permission to admit it. They never did that. So they never were ready, able, and willing to perform this contract. And maybe that tells us a lot about why $100 was put on the table instead of $268,000. We don't want any more money. We want to keep our stock and ride it out. We think that under the plain meaning of the preamble we've read over and over, Doug doesn't have to surrender his stock for this price. Thank you.
One final question. Were all of these documents attached to the pleadings?
All the contracts? Yes, they were.
They were.
Yes.
That's why the trial court granted judgment on the pleadings rather than summary judgment?
That is true. Both parties made motions for judgment on the pleadings, and the court granted FMBs and denied ours. There were some additional issues raised, like the timeliness of the exercise that were not decided by judgment on the pleadings when that's followed at the trial. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Sanford. The court will be in recess until tomorrow at 9 a.m.